Good afternoon. My name is Donna Odierna. I am a researcher at the University of California, San Francisco in the Department of Clinical Pharmacy, and I'm a member of the U.S. branch of the San Francisco branch of the U.S. Cochrane Center. I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors, Jenny White, Susan Forsyth, and Lisa Barrow, who is the principal investigator at the project I'm going to be talking about, and we have received our funding from the Flight Attendant Medical Research Institute. We have no relationships to disclose. So health information can be very confusing. We get a lot of mixed messages and a lot of conflicting recommendations. And they come from different sources. We may get information from consumer advocate groups that may or may not be funded by industry. And of course, we all want to try that new and improved pill as seen on TV. And then we get a lot of information after studies are published about information that comes out later about problems and health effects and conflicting information. So one way to cope with the influx of information that we get is to increase skills in understanding it and evaluating it. But this may be particularly problematic and challenging for health disparities populations if they begin with lower levels of health literacy. So this definition of health literacy comes from Healthy People 2010. I'm sure we're all familiar with it. The degree to which individuals have the capacity to obtain, process, and understand basic health information needed to make appropriate health decisions. But that has a wide range of operational definitions. I think a previous presenter was actually talking about the ability to understand basic health information, which can actually start with the ability to read and follow directions on prescription bottles, all the way up to the ability to use health evidence in decision-making and communication. So how can we increase health literacy, particularly the ability to understand and use health information and health evidence in decision-making and communication? And we think that we can do that through increasing critical appraisal skills, that is, the ability to identify useful health information, to evaluate information for validity and applicability, and to analyze the way results are presented. So to this end, the objectives of our project were to increase the ability of healthcare consumers and consumer advocates to more effectively evaluate and use health evidence in healthcare decision making and in communication with policymakers, to increase clinicians' ability to use research in decision making and in communicating with patients. And also, our other target group was journalists, because we get a lot of our information from journalists, all of us, clinicians, researchers, patients. And we wanted to be able to promote balanced and accurate reporting of health evidence by that group. The intervention that we developed is a critical appraisal workshop. So they're for healthcare consumers and consumer advocates. And we think this is really important because mostly this is done with clinicians. And in fact, a lot of our colleagues in our research group at UCSF actually doubted whether or not consumers and consumer advocates were really going to be able to learn this information and learn the skills. So we conducted, so far, it's an in-progress project, four workshops with consumers in 2010, three with clinicians and one with journalists, which is not included in the analysis. We just did that one. And we have additional workshops coming up. We spent a lot of time planning the workshops, almost a year. We used a community engagement strategy in which we did a consultation with CTSI at UCSF, where we do community academic partnerships. We did a number of key informant interviews, and we spent time planning our workshops with representatives of the participant groups to figure out what level did we need to present the information at, and what subject matter could we use in our case studies and hands-on exercises that would be of interest to the participants. So this is a sample workshop for consumers. With consumers, we always make sure that, you know, we feed them, because we're looking at consumer advocacy groups and we're trying to attract consumers who are not normally included in this kind of intervention. We do a lecture part. There's a lecture part and a hands-on group session. In all of our research evaluation workshops for every group, we go over study designs, RCTs, cohort studies, and systematic reviews. We talk about presentations of results, especially absolute and relative risk reduction and increase, because as you know, when results are presented in a relative fashion, effects can be magnified in the conclusions, and we do some hands-on small group sessions. I'll talk about more of those in a minute. We talk a lot about financial conflict of interest and bias in research. So this is the framework that we use. Bias can be intentionally or unintentionally introduced at any point in research, starting by how we frame the question, all the way through conduct of the research and how it is disseminated and how results are presented. So this is an example of a paper that we use in small group sessions. This is the Jupiter trial of Crestor, which has gotten a lot of press. We've been using this one since an earlier, when it first came out, and so we've actually been following it through the press in our workshops. And what we do is we do cheat sheets. So we use a lot of highlighting and a lot of pop-outs to help our participants, you know, follow what to look at, because we do have limited time. We also spend a lot of time talking about financial conflicts of interest, as I said, in this particular one. That looks like a lot of conflict of interest. It's actually about a quarter of what's in this paper. And then we look at media reporting of the paper. In this particular paper, this was a New York Times article that came out the same day that the paper was released, and you see cholesterol-fighting drugs show wider benefit. They presented absolute risk reduction, and they were very uncritical. And then a week later, Tara Parker Pope had an article, A Call for Caution in the Rush to Statins, with a lot more information. And so the people in our workshops get a sense of how to follow media reports and what to start looking for. We actually follow this through for another whole year after the FDA approved the expanded indications for use of Crestor as prevention. So we evaluate our results using a demographic questionnaire. We do our pre and post questions on screen with a technology called Turning Point, in which people use little keypads, and we look at confidence and knowledge. We record discussions as well for attitudes toward research and toward funding of research, and then we do a post-workshop evaluation follow-up 6 to 12 months later. We're still in the process of doing that, so we actually don't have quantitative results from that. So previous studies have mostly been conducted with healthcare professionals, and the results have been inconsistent. So these are our participants so far. Mostly we have done consumer advocates. We tend to get a lot of response from those groups. Some providers, and then 21% identify as other. We've done a lot of outreach to try to get diverse populations, but still we have mostly about two-thirds of our participants are white, and they're fairly high income. We think that's because we haven't disaggregated the results yet. We think that's because we have some healthcare providers who actually bring the income up a lot. When we do further analysis, we should see a little difference. Most of our participants are women, and they're very highly educated. They also tend to be older, but that's because two of our big groups were the California Association of Retired Americans, so that kind of brought up our, they were great. So this is typical results that we have in our confidence and knowledge change. So let me explain this. So over here we have a percentage of respondents who reported high confidence on a Likert scale of their ability to understand the results of a scientific study. That started out pretty high, about 38% said they could, 48% after. But when we asked them about particular things that we studied, such as absolute risk reduction and relative risk reduction, we saw much greater improvement in their confidence. Also then when we did some knowledge testing, their ability to correctly identify statistical significance and explain the construct of generalizability, you see again you've got high baseline results, so less improvement. And that tended to be consistent across all of our questions. But what was really interesting was it was consistent across all of our groups, so the consumers improved just as much as the physicians did. Well, the healthcare providers, we didn't get many physicians yet. Here's another one on systematic reviews, where their confidence in explaining what a systematic review went up to over 50%. But this one was really interesting. The ability to use it as a tool that is understanding a high-quality systematic review usually provides stronger evidence than individual studies went up to 90%. So at the end of the workshops, folks said they were going to be using scientific articles more to evaluate treatment options, to educate clients, and to plan programs, that they would be looking beyond the headlines and looking beyond the title of the article to look critically at articles, media stories, and drug ads. People mentioned a lot they were going to pay attention to absolute versus relative risk reduction, and they were going to look at what population was being studied to see whether or not the results applied to themselves or their clients or their patients. Very commonly, people said, watch out for the funding source. This was a big theme. I have to say, we didn't have a lot of, you know, naive groups come to these workshops. They started out being incredibly skeptical already. They were a really tough crowd. But now they actually knew what to look for and how to find bias. And they were going to be using new resources, including Cochrane reviews, probably because we really talked those up. So 6 months later, we actually have, we had 128 people that we analyzed for the previous results, and we have 40 questionnaires back on the follow-ups. We haven't even sent them out for some of the groups because it's not 6 months yet. But so far, we found that they have changed behavior. People said they found good sources of information and that they were critically appraising papers to see whether or not they were good papers. They looked at risk-benefit, particularly absolute and relative risk reduction. And people said a lot they were looking at financial conflicts of interest. They also said they were looking more critically at advertisements and at media reports, and that they were using their workshop skills in communication with family, friends, and providers or patients, depending on what their role was, and in health advocacy work. We've had some really interesting health advocacy groups. I mentioned we had CARA. We also had Breast Cancer Action and Disability Health Coalition and Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund, which included a group of parents of children with disabilities. Most notably autism, and we actually had them look at the Wakefield paper. That was a really interesting discussion. They also said that they used workshop skills in healthcare decision making, not just for themselves, but also for their programs. So this is a preliminary analysis. We don't have a control group. We're just doing pre and post and follow-up questions, and our sampling is by people who are interested in coming. So we're including people who want to be there. We are having really a lot of trouble recruiting low-income and minority participants. It's proving challenging. We have ongoing efforts with stakeholders from diverse groups, and we're getting consultants from those groups and trying to increase our ability to attract folks from diverse groups. And it's really hard to get journalists and physicians to come. Physicians all want CMEs, and that's way beyond our budget, so we're having trouble getting doctors. And journalists are just real busy people and hard to pin down. But from what we can tell so far, the training does appear to be equally effective across the diverse populations we're looking at, because the results are similar across all the groups we've looked at. And we're getting a lot of very positive feedback from it, you know, whether or not that's, you know, a valid way to evaluate a program is, you know, of course, difficult to say, but we actually use the feedback to then improve the next workshop. So obviously what you can learn in a one-day workshop, these are from 4 to 7 hours, are not particularly sophisticated, but we did see a general increase in confidence, knowledge, and in comfort level in critically appraising health information, and we are going to be using this information to create an online course for consumers. This is one of our favorite quotes from a consumer advocate. Don't forget to look for the little man behind the curtain, follow the money. Interestingly enough, our funder mostly works with secondhand smoke and the effects of tobacco, and we do use those examples in our workshops, and we tell them up front. And so one of several people has said, well, every time I see a tobacco example, I think about your funder, and that's why you're doing it. And that's actually what we want them to learn. We want them to critically appraise information they get from every source, including us. So thank you. And that is a glorious typo, isn't it? Thank you very much.
Questions for Donna?
Oh, yeah.
This is really very interesting work. But I do think that there's a distinction between funding source and bias. And so do you go into a discussion of teaching patients or professionals how to look for evidence of bias in a study that something was not performed the way it should have been versus just so-and-so got a payoff?
Yes, we absolutely do. So what we say is that just because something is funded by industry doesn't mean it's biased, but it's at high risk for bias. And we actually show the effect of funding on results in various studies, some of which were performed by RPI. So we talk about we do look at sampling bias, attrition bias, publication bias. So yes, we do. Well, with the Cochrane reviews, we do tell them about the summary, and we also we give them a lot of different sources they can look at. It is true they do not have access to journal articles, and they do bring that up a lot. So we're going to be doing some interviews later to figure out to get more of a sense of that. So I don't know how they're dealing with that so much, but they have mentioned that they don't always have access to the articles. Is that it? Thanks.